non-incarcerated people, or for that matter, frankly, allowing incarcerated people to simply not be incarcerated so they can actually be active and, you know, fulfilled members of our society, we turn to prison labor. And prison labor is used in so many different aspects of our capitalist society. Firefighting is one of them. I personally haven't had the chance to interact with any of the firefighters here because they're in the thick of it, in the throes of fighting the fires. But to me, this is why I talk about how it's important for us to start veering away from policing and in prisons and into keeping us really safe. Incarcerated firefighters are trying to keep us safe, but they themselves are part of the architecture of violence, and they are the victims of the architecture of violence as well. In my new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World Is Possible, I speak with 12 abolitionists who talk about these very issues, about how we need to start funding the things that truly keep us safe. The climate, right? One of the people I interview is Leah Penniman, who works on food justice issues. Melina Abdullah, who talks about participatory budgeting. The great Gina Dent, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, Dylan Rodriguez, longtime abolitionists who talk about the importance of pulling money out of policing and the architectures of death making and into the things that keep us safe. Robin D.G. Kelly, who wrote the foreword to the book, who's been on Democracy Now many times. You know, there are people who have been thinking so for so long and strategically about primarily Black leaders and activists who I interview in the book, who have been thinking about how we start applying an abolitionist framework to our economy, to our society. And in such a framework, in such a world, we would not only be climate resilient, we would not only not have incarceration at the mass level that we do now, we would have less crime, we would have fewer fires because we would have dealt with the climate crisis, and we would have more resilient homes, and we would have equity along racial lines. This is the world that we need to manifest and make happen and actually fight for, rather than the apocalyptic promise of racial capitalism and policing and prisons, which is what we're living in right now.
And people can recognize the incarcerated firefighters by their orange jumpsuits. Yes. I want to also bring in Leah Stokes, Associate Professor of Environmental Politics at University of California, Santa Barbara, author of Short Circuiting Policy, co-host of the podcast A Matter of Degrees. Professor Stokes, talk about climate change and what we're seeing today. There's a lot of discussion about individuals responsible for these fires. Almost no discussion. Yes, we hear about the Santa Ana winds, the fierce winds. We hear about the very dry weather. But I mean, what, 1/100th of an inch of rain since beginning of October, when it's usually 4.5 to 5 inches? Can you talk about how climate change contributes to the catastrophe we're seeing in your state?
Absolutely, Amy. You really hit it on the nose there. Who is responsible? It's fossil fuel companies and electric utilities who lied about climate science for decades. And, you know, that's why laws, for example, in Vermont and New York, where they've just passed these Superfund laws to basically hold big polluters accountable to make them pay for these disasters. I can only imagine that California will be thinking about that, too. We know that climate change is the main driver here. The fact is that LA County, more than 80% of it is under extreme drought. And we're looking at the driest 20-year period in 1,200 years. And there have been papers, academic, scientific, peer-reviewed papers that are almost 10 years old now, which showed that more than twice the amount of area is burning in California that would have otherwise because of climate change, and that climate change is the main driver of all this dryness. And the other thing that climate change is doing is it's leading to more extreme precipitation and sometimes, and then more extreme dryness, right? And so last year, last sort of wet season, there was an enormous amount of water that fell in Southern California. That led to a lot of new fuel being built up, you know, all this chaparral, the bushes that they grow grow. And then the next year, which we're in right now, the October period starts that rainy season. When no rain is falling, all of that new fuel, it builds up, it dies. And then when these massive hurricane force winds hit during January and you have this period of dryness, that overlap of these extreme winds and that dry landscape, that parched drought landscape, that's what creates this tinderbox situation. And in the past, you know, we wouldn't have had the same overlap where you would have had such extreme drought and these winds at the same time. And so that's what's really creating such a dangerous situation for people.
And the Santa Ana winds, if you can explain more, because of course, they are well known, these fierce winds, but this, what is called, I mean, the media will talk about the perfect storm, but not the climate catastrophe and what it would mean to change the way we live.
Yeah. You know, the ultimate driver here is climate change. There's been a lot of reporting that, you know, people can do things to try to protect their homes, you know, things like metal roofs or reducing the amount of vegetation that's close to a building. But how are you supposed to do that in a hurricane force wind when there are embers flying everywhere? You know, if one neighbor their home lights on fire, that just creates a massive fuel source for all the other areas. There are things we can be doing in terms of urban planning, how closely we're building these homes together and whether or not we're building them in this wildland urban interface in places that are more likely to burn. But again, I don't think it's about blaming individual homeowners here or thinking that there's some magical solution for how we can harden infrastructure during red flag warnings, you know, where such extreme confluence of dryness and wind comes together. You know, we're about to go into another one of those experiences just tonight in LA and Ventura County. The fact is that the number one thing we have to do to really get at the root cause of this disease is to stop burning fossil fuels. And people have been saying that for decades, including Octavia Butler, who wrote that extremely prescient book, you know, that didn't just talk about climate change, but also she had forecast that a fascist president came to power in her story on a slogan, a campaign slogan of Make America Great Again. So in these horrible disasters, you know, people can turn away from facts and reality, and that can create even more danger. But what we really need to do is reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. We need to electrify all the buildings that we can, including our infrastructure, our transportation, and that will also make us safer next time. You know, when we're building back these communities, we need to be building them back electric. And we need to be making sure that our infrastructure, like water pumping stations, have backup energy through things like battery and solar backups. That can make sure that we're safer for the next fires.
So let me ask you something, Professor Stokes. Governor Newsom has been saying, you know, I mean, when you consider it, the scale of the horror, they're going to deregulate so people can build quickly. But what about the problem with this, deregulating what the requirements are? For example, Los Angeles County identified 70% of its burned areas this year as being in very high-risk zones. Do you think that development continuing in these areas is a problem? And the idea that everything has to be even more regulated, considering the causes of climate change.
Yeah, it's really tragic. You know, these communities go back, you know, decades, a century, and people have really long-term relationships with the landscape. But the fact is that the places where they were living, they're becoming less and less safe. And what I can imagine might happen, given what happened in Santa Barbara and Montecito, you know, my community after the Thomas Fire, is that after this horrible months-long fire that affected so many people, we then had half an inch of rain fall in 5 minutes in Montecito. And this is one of the richest zip codes in America. It led to horrible mudslides, which killed people, some, you know, lower income Hispanic communities, but also very, very wealthy people died in those mudslides. And that is what we will see if we have extreme rainfall, you know, in February and March on these, you know, hills that have been burned out because there's nothing to hold back. There's no vegetation left. There's no roots to hold back mudslides. And so I think that will cause some really hard questions about are these places where people really want to be building back at that same density with that same risk? I feel really terrible for the people who are going through this, especially lower income communities who don't necessarily have the resources to just up and move somewhere else, or who are living in these tight-knit communities that go back decades. And I think it's really tragic, but we do have to be asking tough questions because of the climate crisis, because we have not stopped burning fossil fuels, about where it is safer and less safe to be building back.
Leah Stokes, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Associate Professor of Environmental Politics at the University of California, Santa Barbara, climate researcher. And I also want to thank Sonali Kahatkar, the well-known TV and radio broadcaster who does the show Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. Coming up next, we go to Gaza. We'll speak with journalist Aboubakar Abed. The AAS. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Gaza, where Israel's assault on the besieged strip continues despite ongoing talks over a possible ceasefire. Palestinian authorities say 5,000 people are missing or have been killed in this first 100 days of Israel's siege of North Gaza. Since Monday morning, 33 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. Al Jazeera Arabic reports, including 5 people who died in an Israeli attack on a school sheltering displaced people in Gaza City. On Friday, Saeed Abu Naban, a Palestinian journalist for the Cairo-based Al Ghad TV, was killed by Israeli forces while reporting in the Nusayrat refugee camp. His funeral held Saturday. This is his colleague, Mohammed Abu Namous.
It is clear that the Israeli occupation wants to target the journalist body that exposes its crimes. While the occupation has utilized its media to say that they only target the resistance and their weapons until the Palestinian journalists have exposed the truth to the world, saying this occupation targets children, women, and unarmed civilians.
The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate reports nearly 200 journalists have been killed in Israeli attacks since October 7, 2023. Over 400 others have been wounded or arrested. On Thursday, Palestinian journalists held a news conference outside Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, where they decried the hypocrisy and neglect of international media organizations. This is reporter Aboubakar Abed.
We are just documenting a genocide against us. It's enough after almost a year and a half. We want you to stand foot by foot with us because we are like any other journalists, reporters, and media workers all across the globe, no matter the origin, the color, or the race. Journalism is not a crime. We are not a target.
For more, journalist Aboubakar Abed joins us now from Gaza. He used to be a soccer commentator, but now he calls himself an accidental war correspondent. His new piece for Dropsite News is headlined, What It's Truly Like to Sleep in a Damp, Frigid Tent, a report from Gaza. He's joining us from Deir al-Balah, where that news conference was held. Aboubakar Abed, thank you for joining us again. You're 22 years old. You didn't expect to be a war correspondent, but that's what you are now. Talk more about what you were demanding on Thursday, surrounded by other Palestinian journalists, demanding of the Western media, of all international journalists.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. So what I demanded was very simple, just the basic human rights as any other people across the globe, particularly for journalists here who have been subjected to sheer violence, brutality and barbarism over the past almost year and a half. Particularly if we talk about, if you have a bit of a comparison between us and any other journalists across the globe. And as I said in this press briefing, that we are working in makeshift tented camps and workplaces. I personally talk about myself here. I'm talking about myself here. Just I spent long hours of the day just trying to finalize a story or finalize a report just to tell people the truth. And sometimes we don't have the internet connection. We have been through starvation. We have been through freezing temperatures. We have been taking shelter in dilapidated tents. We haven't been given any sort of a human right at all. So this is what I really demanded, because what I've been seeing for the past 14 months from international media outlets is absolutely enraging. Like, I do have the same rights. Like, what if we were in another spot in the world? The world would absolutely be standing with us and giving us everything we wanted. But why, when it comes to Palestinian, it's a completely different story. We understand that we've been taught as a young man, I've been always taught that the world cares about the human rights of every single person in the world. But I haven't seen any of those human rights as a Palestinian. What have I got to do with this war? So I was subjected to this scale of barbarism and this starvation and this, you know, cold and just all of these diseases. Even right now, while I'm talking to you, Amy, I've been diagnosed with a bronchitis. I'm still recovering from it. There are no right to proper medications inside any of the pharmacies here in Deir el-Balah, where more than a million people are taking shelter. Even if we talk about it in detail, the lack of medical supplies and aid inside the Al-Aqsa Matters Hospital here, which serves more than 1.5 million people in central Gaza, apart from the everyday casualties, is literally insane. When we talk about that, when we talk about the Palestinian journalists, we've lost around 210, and even after the press briefing, another journalist was killed. So you talk to an absolutely dead conscience of the world. You're talking about, like, you're talking like the world just keeps turning a blind eye and a blind eye and just a deaf ear to what is happening as we are talking to ourselves. So it's completely enraging and unacceptable, because we are like, again, we are like any other reporters, media workers and journalists across the globe, and we have the right to be given the access to all media equipment, the access to the world, and our voices must be amplified. Because again, we don't have any party to this war, and we must be protected by all the international laws, because that's what has been enshrined in the international laws and the human rights that have always been taught to the entirety of the world.
We should make clear that all media has access to journalists on the ground in Gaza. Our Democracy Now! Viewers and listeners know we go regularly to Gaza, almost unheard of in the rest of the American corporate media. Yes, they are banned, and that should be raised every time they report on Israel and Gaza, that they are not allowed there. Abu Bakr Abed, what would it mean if there was more attention brought to the journalists on the ground in Gaza? According to a number of reports, well over 150 nearly 250 journalists have been killed, most recently this weekend in Nusrat. Is that right, Abu Bakr?
Yes, I mean, like, the reports are always horrific. Even when we go to a particular place to report on a specific event in the continuously deteriorating a humanitarian situation, we know that this might be the end. We know that even everything we're doing right now to report on, or anything we're trying to tell, any story that we are trying to narrate to the outside world, is going to cost our lives. But we want to tell the world. We want to live in dignity. We want to live in peace, in calm, because that's what we really deserve as any other people across the globe. But it just keeps going like this, because, like, again, you said it in the beginning that I shouldn't have been an accidental war correspondent, but that's what I've evolved into, because this is my homeland. This is something that I have to defend wholeheartedly. But yes, even when I'm trying to do this, I'm not given the basic things. I'm not given the basic human rights. So every journalist here that is working tirelessly, that has been working relentlessly since the outbreak of this genocidal assault in Gaza, has faced unimaginable horrors. We have, I myself, lost my very dearest friend, lost family members, and lost many of my friends and many of my loved ones. But I still continue to hope. I still continue to endure the harsh, the stark realities of living inside Gaza, because Gaza is now the hellscape. Absolutely, it's the apocalyptic hellscape of the world. It's not livable at all. And children, particularly, because I've been talking to many children and reporting on them, we can see that children are barefoot, they are traumatized, their clothes are ripped apart, and they are desperately needing just a sip of water and a bite of food, but that is not available because Israel continues applying the collective punishment on all people of the Gaza Strip. And again, I just want to reaffirm that, and I just want to reiterate it, which is that half of the Gaza population is children. So what have these children got to do with such a genocidal assault in Gaza? So they should have the right to educate, because they have been deprived of their education for the past year and a half, almost. And they have been deprived of they have been deprived of every basic right, even their necessities and their childhood and everything about them. The same for us as young men. I should have completed my study. Unfortunately, my university has been reduced to rubble. Everything about Gaza, everything about my dreams, my memories, has also been razed to the ground and has also been reduced to ashes. So Israel does not have, amid the growing in use of a possible ceasefire on the line, on the horizon, I can tell you that from here, that we are very hopeful. There is a state of optimism and anticipation for a ceasefire, because people, including me, want to heal up, want to let our wounds, our stretcher wounds, heal up, and we want to really have one moment of not hearing the buzzing sounds of the drones and the hovering of warplanes, particularly during the night hours, because the thoughts every single day, we are very much traumatized, and we really need rehabilitation to really get to our lives, to get to who we were before this war started. So it's a very much needed thing, because people are really crying for it. People are really hopeful about it, and I hope that this will not dash their hopes, the continuous attacks on Gaza, and I hope that they will have their dreams coming true very, very soon in the coming days.
Abu Bakr Abed, we want to thank you so much for being with us. 22-year-old journalist speaking to us from Deir al-Balah, Gaza. Used to be a soccer commentator. Now, as he calls himself, an accidental war correspondent. Coming up next, we look at an effort to hold individual Israeli soldiers accountable for war crimes. Back in 20 seconds.
لازم نحكي على اللي كان واللي حيكون وعز كيدوم على سما بتبرق نجوم يا صبر طويل مهما طال الليل مش حنقبل فيه لأنها بلدنا وحضلها حلوة
Balada by El Farai and Rora Azar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with a look at a new effort to hold Israeli soldiers accountable despite a climate of impunity for crimes committed in Gaza. Last week, Poland adopted a resolution ensuring that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be guaranteed safe entry to Poland to attend ceremonies marking 80 years since the liberation of the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. Poland's deputy foreign minister had said earlier Poland would comply with the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants if Netanyahu visited Poland. Here in the U.S., the House of Representatives voted last week to sanction the International Criminal Court over arrest warrants for Netanyahu and the former military chief, Yoav Gallant. But in Belgium, a nonprofit called the Hind Rijab Foundation filed a lawsuit Thursday against an Israeli soldier in Sweden who they accuse of playing a direct role in the targeting of civilians and destruction of homes. Earlier this month, Israel's embassy in Brazil helped a 21-year-old Israeli Army reservist flee Brazil after a Brazilian federal court ordered police to open an investigation into possible war crimes he committed in Gaza. That case had also been filed by the Hind Rijab Foundation. The Brussels-based nonprofit is named after 6-year-old Hind Rijab, who was killed along with her family in a January 2024 Israeli attack as they were in a car escaping bombardment in Gaza City, a story we covered extensively. For more, we're joined now in Brussels by Diab Abujaja, co-founder of the Hind Rijab Foundation. Diab, thank you for joining us. Explain what you are calling for. Talk about the Brazilian case and also the one in Sweden and where you get your information about what these Israeli soldiers specifically have done.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks for having me. Indeed, as you said in your presentation, our mission is seeking accountability, seeking justice, basically. It is a sad thing that citizens as ourselves should be doing this, because normally this should be an automatic thing that states and legal bodies, international legal bodies, should be seeking. However, it is, of course, our right as citizens to do that when these countries mostly default on their responsibilities. So what we do is monitor the posts of Israeli soldiers who have been extensively, as you know and everybody knows, posting things out of Gaza, out of the ongoing genocide there. And we look for criminal activity because, obviously we only target soldiers who have posted things of themselves that we consider, legally speaking, as war crimes, at least, and maybe more than war crimes. So this is the, every research we do is open intelligence, open source intelligence. So this is how we function. Once we have evidence, we pass it to our legal teams. They prepare cases and then they file it when the subject enters a country where that has jurisdiction or let's say activating jurisdiction of that country over these things. So this is what happened in Brazil. This is what happened before Brazil in Cyprus as well. And also, as you mentioned, in Sweden. So this is basically our way of operating.
We only have a minute, but can you talk about the Brazil case of the Israeli soldier and, again, how you get the information about what they specifically did?
Again, the information is posted by themselves. So we analyze it and we turn, social media posts basically into legal cases. I just want to, since you said we just have a minute, I want to take the opportunity to say that the countries of the world should take their responsibilities. As we speak, Major Ghassan Alian, who is the head of COGAT, which is the entity that oversees the weaponizing of famine in Gaza, is present in Italy to attend a meeting secretly. Have filed a case against them in the International Criminal Court, asking them to activate any arrest warrant that they have against them, or if not, issue a new one. And we also informed the Italian authorities, asking them to activate their responsibility under the Rome Statute, which, since they have jurisdiction and since Major General Alian does not have immunity. This is an example that is now unfolding of how the countries of this world should take their responsibilities. And, I think the Brazilian case was a case where that happened, where a judge actually issued a probe order to investigate a soldier. Unfortunately, the Israeli government smuggled the soldier out of Brazil, which is, of course, obstructing justice. But we are continuing. We are relentless in seeking justice. And we are very convinced that one day justice also will be served in a court of law.
Tiab Abujaja, we want to thank you for being with us, co-founder of the Hind Rajab Foundation, the Belgium-based group advocating for Palestinian rights. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.